And you're tuned in to Out There on Valley Free Radio. It's Tuesday, April 21st. I feel like it should be the first day of spring, but it still feels like winter. Oh, wait, that was March when spring came. Well, anyway, here we are on a rainy, rainy day. Today's show, I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Out There airs every Tuesday from 3 until 4. And today's show, I have an interview with Dwayne the Dog Rainey of Cans for Cancer. Today was kickoff day for Cans for Cancer out at Valley Recycling. So I got about 8 or 9 minutes with him and his friend Kurt, who's helping him out there. And then the bulk of the show is an interview with Molly Merritt and Kelly Silliman from Western Mass Surge, showing up for racial justice about the reparations campaign that they're doing. And do I have any stories? The only little story I can think of in this moment was when I was hauling my last load of trash coming here this afternoon. I saw this car pulling out of the gas station across from Coolie Dick. And it was this really like greenish yellow, brightly colored oblong kind of car. And all I could think when I looked at it was, that woman's driving a lemon. All right, here's Dwayne. All right, my friends, it's the first day. Cans for Cancer, the grand opening.
Yes, it is.
Dwayne Rainey, founder, creator.
Founder, creator of Cans for Cancer.
Man with a cancer.
Man with a cancer,
man,
yes.
With a cans.
Yes, I am. Yeah, so I've been working on
you
this.
You got to keep a little bit of space, you know,
okay.
Because you got to
put it out. So, I'll put my mask on. I am the Can Bandito. With my mask. My trusty mask for COVID. So today is the first day at Cans for Cancer down here at Valley Recycling.
It was Tuesday, April
2020. It's my first day just opening up, just got the sign up, got some cans, the first donation from fellow people. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, fellow people. They're a great organization, and I love
business.
Them all.
Business, actually. Business.
It's a good business. Great business. Cooperative.
All right, so this background ruckus here. What's Kurt doing?
It's already well on our way to our first million cans. But we're not going to stop there. No, Cans for Cancer is going to be a nonprofit organization that's mission is to assist elderly and low-income people with unexpected, like, cancer bills. Because you get bills from the hospital, and that sometimes your insurance doesn't cover. So I want to take and have create a fund through Cans for Cancer 2.0, may I add. C4C 2.0. I want to create a fund so I can assist those people and other people with cancerous kind of conditions. Because COVID right now is bad enough, but some people have to worry about COVID and other things, their lives actually. So anything I can do to take and help any people that have cancer, like myself, and I am the first recipient of C4C, to make sure that it works out well. We also plan on making donations to other local cancer organizations, the Cancer Connection, the Shriners Hospital. Those will also be included in my mission, as well as to help any other organizations any way that I can. We're also committed to environmental. We need to I want to create awareness on single-use plastics and how much that we use them, and eventually work to expand the bottle bill in Massachusetts.
All right. So if people want to donate, how can they get cans to you?
They can come down here. They can come down to Valley Recycling at the moment. I'm hoping to expand up to the Northampton DPW to help save the city of Northampton money. Because this right here, I am saving Valley Recycling money on recycling costs while creating a fund for my organization. So it's twofold. I'm helping these people, and they're helping me. And so the more people pull together now in this time where there's social distancing, this is one way we can take and pull together for two good common causes. One, to help cancer, and two, to help the environment.
So people can come on down to Valley Recycling, which is on Route 10 between Northampton and East Hampton, the transfer center here.
If the organization has a lot of cans, they can call me on my phone at 413-387-9018, or they can go on my webpage, which would be Dwayne Cancer Cancer 2.0 at Gmail.
Email or Facebook page.
And there's a Facebook page that you can get onto, Dwayne Cancer Cancer Rainey on Facebook. And there's a donate button, so if you want to donate, fine, great. I'll take all donations from anybody who wants to donate to this cause. Mm-hmm. And cans always. We'll be here every day that Valley Recycling is open from 7 o'clock till 4.
Monday through Saturday. We're a big
green shipping container with cancer kits on the side. You can't miss it. Come on down if you want to talk. Come on down if you want to donate. Come on down just to see what's going on.
So, Kurt, can I ask you here, for people want to know what's returnable, what's redeemable or not. Can you give a little rundown of what you're accepting?
Anything that has carbonation to it is returnable. Angry Orchard is absolutely no good. Any cider doesn't have a redemption on it.
Yeah, so aluminum, plastic, glass.
Yeah.
So what's your system here? So once people drop off cans and bottles, then what do?
We sort them and count them.
You sort them by, like,
by cans,
material.
Glass, and plastic.
And then you count them into what, pal? Count them into bags?
Put them in a bag. Every bag's got 200 cans. Plastic is 100. And bottles have to be boxed up.
Okay. And then you got a truck and trailer, and then you drive them. Where do you take them? Is the place in Springfield still open?
Yes.
Okay. So you often... Are you still going to... Do you go to Springfield sometimes?
Yeah, I do go to Springfield sometimes.
Yeah, this is just the start of Cancer Cancer. I plan that it's going to get much bigger very quickly. If anyone wants to take a ballot here or figure out ways that they can donate in other ways, they can always contact me. I have my separate number for Cancer Cancer 2.0. Feel free to call anytime. If you have to leave a message, I'll get back to them. I do respond to Facebook. I'm on that quite a bit. That's also all linked to my phone or in my Gmail, which is cans for, one is cans for cancer with
the number four.
And the other one is spelled out cans for cancer, and that would be Randy. That would be the Facebook page. The other one, cans for cancer 2.0, you put in, and it's going to pop up my email.
Can you say the phone number again?
The phone number is area code 413-387-9018.
I got one more question. So you're in the middle of chemo and stuff right now. How's your energy in doing this project?
Well, luckily, you took a lot of brain power. So I can sit on my butt a lot because, you know, the chemo, it takes a toll on you. But, you know, I have this project, and so I have to. It's inspired me. It got me to think past my own chemo to other people that are going through the same thing that I'm going through. So. Good luck, everyone out there, and see you soon.
Thank you. And that was Dwayne Rainey and Kurt. Dwayne's number is, again, 413-387-9018. If you got any cans, a bunch of cans to donate that you want him to pick up, or you have questions for him, You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. The most of the rest of Out There is an interview with Molly Merritt and Kelly Silliman from Western Mass Surge, showing up for racial justice, talking about reparations. This interview was recorded yesterday, April 20th, in Haydenville. I'm here behind the Haydenville Congregational Church with Molly Merritt and Kelly Silliman. Say hi, my friends.
Hi!
We're being careful to keep our space and all that. Anyway, so Kelly and Molly are involved in Surge's campaign, reparations campaign, Western Mass Surge reparations campaign. What is the reparations campaign? Or, I don't know, should we start there?
For sure, yeah. So Western Mass Surge is part of Surge, which stands for Showing Up for Racial Justice. And it's a national organization that mobilizes white people to work for racial justice. And our chapter has been working on lots of projects for about 5 or 6 years now. And 2 years ago, we decided that we wanted to work on a more focused campaign. And everyone who was involved with the chapter at that point really felt like reparations was really present and important. And so we decided as an act of reparations to raise money to purchase a house for two organizers who live in Springfield.
Oh, yeah, I remember I was involved with Surge at that time, and I remember the sort of feeling of like, oh, what should we do? How can we plug in? We're like white people in a town that's pretty white, and where's our in? So that the reparations campaign seems pretty good for the resources that this community has. How about Molly, are you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, in case people aren't familiar with the concept of reparations, so reparations is the repayment for the taking of life, labor, wealth, and land. And so in the context of our reparations campaign, we are attempting to kind of grapple with the idea of paying reparations to the descendants of enslaved people. Enslaved people from Africa, so African Americans, acknowledging that the labor that was stolen from enslaved people from Africa sort of built this country and laid the foundation for a lot of the institutions that people use to generate wealth in their lives today. So, you know, we're learning about this concept as we sort of engage with this work. And I would say that, you know, none of us are really experts. We're just kind of a community of people who are trying to be less racist white people. So, you know, reparations is really complicated. And there are many people who believe that we need government-wide institutional reparations that are systematically paid out based on tangible calculations of what was actually stolen from people. And that's not what our campaign is. Our campaign is just an attempt to raise awareness about what reparations are, why we think they should be paid, and to redistribute wealth from, in this case, from white people to African Americans.
And I think it's the reason that we chose a house buying campaign was because owning property is one of the main ways that white people have built wealth and generational wealth in this country. And through institutional practices like redlining, people of color have been prevented from that, accessing those same ways of accruing wealth. And so we're drawing like a really direct line between those practices and reparations, repaying the damages and the generational damages that were done. And so that's why we chose people who live in Springfield. I mean, they were also people that have a relationship to our chapter, because Springfield is an area where redlining and gentrification, where the history of redlining is still really present and where gentrification is really taking root, especially with the casino. And it's local to our valley.
What kind of reactions have you gotten from people when you talk about the campaign?
I think people are curious about the concept and they want to know more. Some folks that I've talked to have never really heard of the idea of paying reparations. And I think one thing that I notice as a theme that comes up is this sort of idea of a few things, I guess. One thing being like a lot of desire to kind of deflect blame, sort of like, well, my ancestors didn't own slaves, you know, my family were more recent immigrants to this country, and you know, the government should take control of making a more equitable society, and it's not really my responsibility to do that. So that's an attitude that I've definitely encountered, and you know, been talking with people about that. Another thing that I notice a lot in this conversation is how a lot of us operate from sort of a mentality of scarcity, mm-hmm. that like within this capitalist system that we're a part of, it's very easy to feel like we never have enough, mm-hmm. and that like no one's going to take care of us, so we have to hoard resources. I mean, what's going on now is a really interesting example of that, with this pandemic and people hoarding resources. But I think that's something that shows up in our society in a lot of ways. And when you talk about redistributing wealth, a lot of people have that reaction of, well, like I can barely pay my own bills, or like I'm worried about putting my kids through college, or I'm worried about retirement, so I need to first take care of myself. And you know, people who have a lot of money, maybe that's okay for them to do a project like this. So that's an attitude that I think, you know, a lot of us simultaneously encounter within ourselves and also outside of ourselves, and trying to kind of work with that attitude and break that down a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, it's making me think of a couple things. One is I was biking today, and you know, your wheels are turning, and your bike, and your wheels are turning in your head. And that quote, there's some quote, I don't know if it's like in a document like the Constitution or something, or if it's like a religious thing. The phrase like freedom from want. Do you know where that comes from? Is that familiar to you?
Mm-mm.
It must be a religious thing then. Never mind then. Anyway, I'm just thinking about freedom from want. Is that freedom from need or freedom from desire? What is that? I think the writers meant it to be need, but need and desire, fine line. And then the other thing that what you're saying makes me think of is, so I'm working on this campaign to ship a container load of bikes to Trinidad, and I've made a GoFundMe page, and I've gotten a bunch of donations. But also, like, people are getting stimulus checks or tax refunds, and a lot of people are sending some of that to undocumented people who will never see any of that government money. And so, like, how the money goes around, it's like, you know, I can't really even keep track of it. It's not, like, a logical thing. It's just more of a spirit of generosity that you have to trust.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. This is an interview with Molly Merritt and Kelly Silliman. And I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring.
Something that I was thinking about while Molly was talking as well is that we get told that we have earned everything that we have, or like, mm-hmm. I worked so hard for this, and it's hard to separate out hard work from what we've received, because there are plenty of people who are working really hard who don't get the same thing for what they're for how they're working, or don't have access to the same resources or education or job opportunities or living opportunities that you know, I might have based on class or race. And so something that I think I've come up against when talking with people is that sense of, but I worked for this and it's mine. And those people might still choose to give away money, but they view it as charity or philanthropy as opposed to something that they owe because they've had unearned privilege or resources or access to things that in a way that's inequitable.
What drew each of you into this campaign or doing race relations type work? So much good work to be done. Why this one?
Well, I first kind of was introduced to the concept of whiteness and white privilege in college, and then kind of started to learn about internalized racial superiority, sort of like the conditioning that we receive as white people kind of growing up in this environment where racism is in the air that we breathe, and even if we think that we're, like, you know, educated liberal people, we still hold these racist ideas. So I've been learning, trying to understand and work against my racist conditioning for many, many years. But the thing that motivated me to join Surge was actually the 2016 election, and kind of understanding what a powerful force racism still is in this country in a overt way, not only in this sort of like more covert, internalized way, which is kind of what I had been spending a lot of time thinking about, but like recognizing that like racism is a really powerful motivating tool, and that will, you know, enough so that someone like Donald Trump could get elected, and people aren't going to shy away from him as a potential president because he says things that are just blatantly racist. So that kind of opened my eyes to where like a lot of our country is at around issues of race, and I felt like, you know, it's not kind of enough for me to think about this just in the context of my own life and how I can be a better person. I really have to be trying to figure out how to build community with other people who are working to help white people be less racist, essentially, and like actively do this work with other people, not just sort of internally with myself.
I grew up in a very diverse town, and went through the public school system, but the schools themselves were not particularly diverse, and there was a lot of like white flight throughout my middle school years, and then by high school my school was about 92% black, and there's lots to say about that, but I think many of the educators in our school system were really invested in naming things for the black students that was, well, for all of us, but because of this high percentage of black students, like what was going on and things that were racist, and there was a lot of conversation about race, and it was included in our curriculum, like in literature and history, in ways that I now know was not normal or like the average for a lot of white people. And then as an adult, I've lived in a lot of different places, like conservative places and rural places and cities and now the Valley. And I was surprised when I got here, like to perceive a disconnect between, this like middle and upper middle class white progressive liberalism but then also like a reluctance to talk about race or to acknowledge the way that racism was being perpetuated in our like micro systems, our towns and our policies and the way that people talk about different people who live here. And so I had been increasingly feeling this like rub about that. in the first few years that I lived here, and trying to figure out what to do about it, or, you know, I thought about moving, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm otherwise really happy here.
Yeah.
Surge had come onto my radar maybe like 6 months or a year before the 2016 election, and I had been kind of following it and thinking I should get myself to a meeting. And then similarly, I think the election was the moment where I like finally got my act together to get to a meeting. I was talking a lot at that time with a friend about activism and organizing and overwhelm. And, you know, she was really holding on to that idea that you pick the thing that matters and you do that really well, and you trust that other people will hold up the other things that matter to you. So for me, it just felt like racial justice work was like the place where I wanted to be, and that I and where I could do really meaningful work. And early on, like, you know, we've done things like there's been a lot of like dialogue circle series that. Everything from sort of like a racial justice 101 type of curriculum to like police. What was the name of that one? Something about policing. There's been more like literature based ones, and really opportunities for people to like dig in, you know, to their own work in a held space. And that felt really, you know, important to see happening in this area specifically. So I think I've learned like so much from working with this chapter and from the people who are involved in it. And so the opportunity for my growth has been really incredible as well. So I sort of feel like that's where I cast my lot. And then when the reparations campaign came along, it just felt like, yes, this is like the right next step.
Yeah. Yeah, what you say about thinking about leaving, moving because of just like the demographics and awareness, it resonates with me.
Yeah.
And so many white people here, I think. Well, people of color here too, perhaps, for sure.
I think what I came to is like there's work to be done everywhere. So like I ended up here. This is where I am.
Yeah.
You know, I ended up here for whatever reasons.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to uproot again.
Yeah.
And there's many people that I care for here. And, you know, I say this all the time, but like I didn't have health insurance before I moved here, and I have four kids.
Mm-hmm.
So having like living in a place like Massachusetts and having health insurance and seeing the like social, it's not perfect. It's not, you know, it needs so much work. It's still steeped in all the like isms and capitalism and whatever, but it's still a more of a safety net than I've ever had before.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of really good stuff to say about it. And so I just came to that point where I'm like, this is where I got to do some work, you know?
Yeah. Like for me, like this is a place where my dreams can come true. Like the issue for me is like transportation and biking, and it's a community that supports those things. And like, I'm able to do like, you know, make a living on a bike in a way that would be very difficult anywhere else I can imagine.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm super grateful to people like you who work on these campaigns where I can be a white person in a white place and still do something good about race. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I'm playing an interview from yesterday with Molly Merritt and Kelly Silliman of Western Mass Surge, showing up for racial justice. I'm going to play Gil Scott Heron, and then we'll get more, another 15 or 20 minutes of the interview with Molly and Kelly. Thanks for tuning in today. Okay. Well, for some reason, that song doesn't want to come up. So I'll play Buffy St. Marie and Tanya Tagak, You Got to Run.
Whether you're a woman or whether you're a man, sometimes you got to take a stand, just because you think you can.
should add, whether you're a woman or a man or anything, any gender in between. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm going back to the interview with Molly Merritt and Kelly Silliman. But before I go back, I just want to mention, I just pulled a tick off of me here in the studio, so don't forget to check for ticks, because you don't want to confuse Lyme disease or anaplasmosis or some tick-borne disease with COVID-19 symptoms.
So what are some of the specific things that you all have done with your involvement in the reparations campaign?
I've been trying to talk about reparations with anyone who will engage with me on the topic for a couple of years. I've employed a variety of different methods, and some of them more successful than others. I kind of started out being like, all right, we're doing this campaign. It's so important. I'm going to email everyone I know. I'm going to tell them why I support reparations and why we're doing this campaign, and they're all going to join in and see how important this work is. And it was, you know, I reached out to a bunch of folks and basically didn't hear very much. And I think, you know, there's, like you said, there's a lot of problems in our world and a lot of issues that people could work on. And I think sometimes people feel overwhelmed with requests for help, both like, you know, the emotional capacity to care about issues and also like resources, places to put money. So I've found that trying to reach out to people directly in a like one-on-one conversation or like group conversation seems a lot more effective in terms of allowing people to understand why this is such an important issue for me. So just kind of sitting down with close friends and family and just saying, this is a project that I'm engaged with, and I think it's really important, and would you consider being a part of it? And we've done lots of different things as a chapter to kind of support this campaign. Several of us have had sort of like house parties, I guess, like invited people over to talk about reparations and learn about our campaign and learn about the racial wealth gap and ask questions and also kind of build community. We've done concerts and parties, just like various different ways to kind of bring people in to being engaged with this topic.
We also started it with a kickoff event 2 years ago in May, and that had sort of two parts to it. One was like an educational component, so that we had like tables with that sort of focused on different ideas around reparations, where people sat and you could talk to them. There was like a lot of sort of information posted on the walls, like there's a food justice reparations map that we projected on the wall. So another chapter member at the time made a timeline of sort of historical events that, you know, were related to like things that have happened that impact the need for reparations. And then there was what we called a fishbowl conversation. So the two people who were purchasing a house for, along with a representative from Springfield No One Leaves, which is an organization that helps prevent foreclosures for people in Springfield. There was another person there as well. And they, all people of color who are working with the idea of reparations in their work, sat down and had a conversation with each other. And then the people who attended this event were welcome to sit around and witness that conversation. And so that was our like kickoff event. And then the other thing that we've done is we've invited people to make recurring payments. And on our website, there's a lot of information about that, about why, you know, why to consider that as a way of through a framework of like personal reparations, and as well as a sliding scale with sort of factors to consider as to why you might pay more or less on that scale. Like if you have dependents, or if you have like savings and no debt, you know, those kinds of things. Oh, and the other thing I wanted to say was if people are not familiar with the racial wealth gap, there was a really excellent episode of Explained on Netflix about it. It's about 15 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of chapter members who had house parties where they would show that episode and then, like, you know, support a conversation about it. And so that is a great resource for people.
I wonder if, just like off the top of your head, you could mention some things that have contributed to the racial wealth gap, like redlining, or the thing, like specific, like the Chinese Exclusion Act or GI Bill limitations. I don't know, any things like that.
Yeah. Redlining is the biggest one, and it's, I hope I can do it justice if I try to explain it, but it was, the name comes from the lines in red on the map that insurance companies, I think, would draw to designate, like, where they considered high-risk and low-risk lending areas. And so the, like, high-risk areas were areas, communities of color. And then, and so those people couldn't get loans to purchase homes, so they would end up renting. And then that, you know, that didn't get passed on. There was also a history of, like, one of the ways that people of color would try to purchase houses would be, like, a rent-to-own situation, but those were, tended to be, like, predatory, so you could pay and pay and pay, but if you missed one payment, the person who owned the house could just kick you out and not return any of that money, and that would happen to people all the time.
Yeah, another thing similarly, I mean, being able to own land and pass that land and homes and pass that on to your children is like a huge way in which wealth is generated in the society. And along with practices in like lending and housing, like Kelly was talking about, there's a really significant history of just basically Black people being terrorized by white people and being forced to leave parcels of land that they owned, largely in the South, but probably in all parts of this country. So there's, yeah, that's a piece of history too, where, you know, something that would have allowed a family to build wealth intergenerationally is taken away. And I don't know. That's not like a specific institution, but just like practice of racial terror.
And I think it's just I think it's probably important also to mention, since we're talking about like owning land, that of course all of this land was stolen from First Nations people who lived here before any settlers came, and so that is a complicated part of the conversation when we're talking about stolen land.
Yeah. How do you? Well, a couple things are coming to mind. One is, you know, about like Trump's dissolution of the Mashpee Wampanoag territories, like right now that's being fought. But then also with this campaign, how do you address questions like, well, what about the stolen land? Like, why aren't we paying reparations to First Peoples, First Nations?
That's definitely a conversation that needs to be had. And I think many of us involved with Surge are having those conversations, like, you know, with our families and communities. And this campaign specifically focuses on reparations for descendants of enslaved Africans. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to be doing other reparations work to acknowledge the stolen land from Indigenous people. So it's not, I think to us, it's not like mutually exclusive. It's not like this is more important than other kinds of work that address the histories of other marginalized groups. It's just like, okay, here's a thing that we can do now, and we'll work on this project, and like maybe our chapter will work on some kind of project that addresses reparations to Indigenous people at some point. I think that's something that we all like would like to educate ourselves more about and work on.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. This is an interview, a conversation with Molly Merritt and Kelly Silliman from Western Mass Surge, showing up for racial justice. So when the reparations campaign got going, and I was trying to decide how much I wanted to contribute to it. Then a year and a half ago, we finished paying off our house, so I suddenly had a lot fewer bills. Actually, that's really complicated. I don't have very many fewer bills, the way that we've structured it. Actually, the way we structured it in my house is that Alex and I, who are homeowners of our half of the house, we still put in $300 a month towards carrying costs and stuff. And then other housemates who are living with us, we encourage them to pay whatever they will, whatever they can, whatever they want to the reparations campaign or some other similar, social justice kind of work. But when we finished paying off our house, then I thought, okay, my goal for the upcoming year, I would like to put $5,000 towards reparations. And then I got involved in this. When I was working a lot, I made about $15,000 to $17,000 a year. This year I got really involved in this Trinidad Bicycle Osmosis Project. I'm like, okay, I think I'm probably gonna end up spending $5,000 of my own money for this project, plus the GoFundMe money. And can I count that as reparations, or is that kind of a joyride sort of kind of thing? I'm like, well, we'll just consider that neutral. It's still the reparations work that needs to be done right here in the United States, right here. It's really important.
Well, I think wealth redistribution is really important any way you do it. Mm-hmm. Acknowledging the fact that those of us who are white in this country have huge economic advantages just by virtue of the social construction of race, and acknowledging that in order to have a more fair world, we need to redistribute that money. To me, it seems reparations to the descendants of enslaved people from Africa is definitely part of that, but I think it doesn't have to be the only way to redistribute money. I forget which one of you brought it up, but giving your stimulus check to an undocumented family, that's wealth redistribution. That's kind of acknowledging your privilege, as a white person and as a person, a documented person in this country. To me, specific reparations we're working on in this campaign are really important, but for me, more broadly, it's the concept of wealth redistribution that I feel really strongly about. Just to answer your question, I would say that's just equally important to me.
I like how on the Surge campaign, the donate website, when it's giving suggested guidelines for how much maybe people could give, it includes a lot of those factors beyond just the amount you bring in a paycheck. Because for me, I make $15,000 a year, but I'm way wealthier than that. My parents own their own land. I have all that, had such a big safety net with family and friends, and I know so many white people with money.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. And all other kind of resources, every resource you can imagine. Anyway, what else? Anything else? Oh, how people can get involved.
Yeah, well, we have a website, Western Mass Surge, WMSURJ. Is it .com or .org?
.com.
And it talks a lot about our campaign. And on that website, people can sign up to make monthly payments or a one-time payment. And there's also information on our website about our meetings. Obviously, we are not doing in-person meetings at this time, but we have a once-a-month general meeting that's open to anyone who's interested in any way. We held our April meeting over Zoom, and presumably we'll be doing that for the next several months. But the schedule of when our meetings are is on our website. So that is a great way for someone to get involved if they're just kind of curious about the work that we do and maybe being involved in our chapter.
We also have a mailing list that, so the information for the meetings gets sent out via the mailing list, and also on, there's a Facebook page that people can like and follow. Mm-hmm. There is a resources page on the website as well that has a ton of resources about reparations, and I think probably other things as well. And I think Surge National's site, which is just, I think, showing up for racialjustice.org, has a ton of really great resources for people who are new to the work. A lot of information about, like, Surge's values and about how class and race intersect. And more, like, general information or national information about the work that's being done.
Yeah, I think it's really important to note that even if people can't contribute financially, there's so many ways people can contribute to the work of reparations.
Right.
Is there anything, any scheduled, I don't know, events, house parties, things coming up?
No, the campaign, we intended for it to run through the end of 2019. Mm-hmm. And then, and our goal was to earn the money. And we actually exceeded our goal, which is really incredible. And the goal amount was based on a particular house that we thought was going to be available to purchase. And it turned out that it wasn't, which we discovered sort of halfway through 2019. Uh-huh. And so now we're involved in like kind of a regular house search. There's an agent that our friends in Springfield are working with, and so we're finding that the original amount is really quite low to be able to purchase a house that isn't going to require a lot of repairs.
Yeah.
So that's why we're still continuing to collect payments, because the more that we're able to collect, the more flexibility we'll have when, in choosing the house that is really right for them. I mean, we're not choosing it. They are, just to clarify.
Yeah.
So we started like looking in January and we were just starting to, go to, open houses and to see houses that were available when the pandemic hit. And so things are paused right now as far as like the actual search goes. But I imagine once things, calm down and we're hopefully past the like spike in Massachusetts, we'll be able to continue that. And I'm still optimistic that this could happen by the end of this year. So we're just moving forward with that.
Yeah. So are you in close contact with Sticky
and Shay? Yeah, there's a couple of us who are like in more regular contact. Yes.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, talk to them about what their experience is of the campaign.
That would definitely be interesting.
I mean, they have, I mean, we have had conversations. I don't know that I would feel comfortable speaking on their behalf, but I mean, it's a lot, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot to like consider and navigate.
Yeah,
and we don't feel like we're doing this perfectly, in a way that is like a model example for others to follow. It's just, we have to start. We wanted to start somewhere, and I think that's part of the work as like learning how to be less racist white people. Is like we're going to make mistakes, and then we have to be open to criticism and feedback and learning and doing better.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. That was an interview with Kelly Silliman and Molly Merritt from Western Mass Surge, showing up for racial justice. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Out There airs every Tuesday from 3 until 4 here on WXOJ, followed by Madness Radio up at 4 o'clock and Democracy Now! At 5 o'clock. And many other things streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm going to try to see if I can play this Gil Scott Heron song again. I'm trying to play Who'll Pay Reparations on My Soul.
Who'll pay reparations on my soul?
suggestions and documents written. Many directions for the aid that was given. They gave us pieces of silver and pieces of gold. Tell me who paid reparations on my soul. Many fine speeches,
oh yeah,
from the White House stairs. That were never really there. Yes, but the heat in the summer was there, and the freezing winter's cold. Now tell me, who'll pay reparations on my soul? Call my brother a junkie, say he ain't got no job. Be a man.
Be a man.
Can't depend on no one else.